This Week in Radio Tech is supported by the Broadcaster's Desktop Resource at thebdr.net.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twert.
This Week in Radio Tech, WiMAX, LTE, Ratchet Claws, and Excellence in Engineering.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's him?
All your data belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
With co-hosts Tom Ray, Chris Tobin, Chris Tarr, and special guest Gary Clyde.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
It's time for another This Week in Radio Tech. It's episode number 2. Hello there. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host, and along with me today we have three co-hosts on the show. We have Chris Tobin from New York City. Hello, Chris.
Hello there, Kirk. How are you?
I'm great. Chris is with CBS Radio there. We also have a repeat from last week, Tom Ray from Buckley Broadcasting. Hi, Tom.
Everybody duck. Tom's back. How you doing, Kirk?
I'm great, and thanks for asking. And also, a new co-host with us, a fellow who I met back on the infamous day, 9/11, Chris Tarr from Milwaukee. Hi, Chris.
Hi there, Kirk. How you doing?
I'm good. We have two Chrises on the show, so we got to be careful about that. Some people met Chris Tobin and Tom Ray last week. Chris Tarr, why don't you tell us just a bit about yourself and what you do in Milwaukee?
Well, I'm the director of engineering for Intercom's radio stations in Milwaukee and Madison. There's an AM and five FMs. And I also do a lot of writing for radio magazine, Radio Guide. I run a website called The Virtual Engineer, which is an online forum for exchanging ideas with engineers. And above all of that, father of four kids. So I don't get a lot of sleep.
When do you have time?
I'm trying to find some. I'll let you know.
We're going to jump right in. Should mention about halfway through the show, we're going to bring on a guest. It's going to be Gary Clyde, who is the vice president of engineering and information technology for Cumulus Media. He's received the Radio World Excellence in Engineering Award, and he's been featured in several articles this year, including one called Trends in Radio. We'll have Gary join us in about half an hour. He's going to be joining us by phone. I know he's traveling right now, so we'll bring him on the phone. Let's get right to our topics, gentlemen. One topic, it's kind of a follow-up to what we talked about last week, and that has to do with some of the methods of radio stations being able to communicate high quality or at least good quality audio in real time from out at remote locations using facilities provided publicly, or if you will, or by telephone companies or by private internet service providers or ISPs. And I received an email from Ron Cole this past week talking about Clearwire's Zome Mobile WiMAX and Verizon's LTE networks to be coming out in 2010. He mentions that both of these networks are 100% IP with no switched voice on them. Also, he mentions that AT&T and T-Mobile will be bringing up, or they'll be upgrading to HSPA Plus technology in 2010 as well. I imagine all these will be rolling out in bigger markets first. So, Chris Tobin, last week you were kind of chiming in on what you had been finding in New York City. What do you think about Ron's remarks here about WiMAX and LTE coming out in 2010?
Well, I know talking with the folks at Verizon, LTE is their choice, and it's definitely coming out in 2010. I believe they have it rolled out in two test markets, but New York City, I believe, is scheduled for second quarter of next year. And also, AT&T and the others, their spectrum allocation, though, is much smaller footprint than that of Verizon. So it'll be interesting to see how everybody fares, because Verizon right now has a footprint, I believe, covers 90% of the major, what do they call them, MSAs for the telecom world. AT&T, I think it comes in right behind them, and then Sprint.
I've been reading about a little bit about LTE. It stands for long-term evolution. Chris, do you know much about this technology? What kind of is it limited to certain frequency ranges, or can this tech be used in whatever frequency range that the carrier is operating in?
Last I checked, the LTE works best in the higher frequencies where spectrum can be set up for a large bandwidth, large amounts of bandwidth. Also, the interesting thing about long-term evolution, the LTE or 3GPP, I think is known in other parts of the world, it's designed for real-time applications. So in this case, I guess we'll say real-time audio, and they're also looking at multimedia. One of the seminars I attended several months ago, several folks in the LTE world had mentioned that the telecom industry and those around that have realized that back when 2G came out and they started giving wireless to the customers, people went crazy. Networks were flooded. They couldn't manage the bandwidth, nothing. 3G comes along. They think, oh, yeah, we're great. We've got more bandwidth. We'll give it to the customers. Totally wiped out cell sites all across the country. So I think long-term evolution, WiMAX, and all the others that are coming out have been designed now for that big pipe need. Mm-hmm. Where you know, you have DSL at home, cable modem. Take that experience or expectation out to the wireless world.
Certainly this marketing term, LTE, long-term evolution, lends itself to people latching onto it, I suppose. It sounds good. I was just looking up here. Apparently in the U.S., LTE could be used in a number of different frequency bands, 1.7 and 2.1 gigahertz cellular 850 and UMTS 850. Also in the 1700 megahertz area, 1.7 gigahertz. So it looks like it's not limited in any particular frequencies. It's you can use it in various places.
700 megahertz is where Verizon's putting their LTE.
Ah, okay. Now, I should back up and explain a bit for folks listening who are not broadcast engineers that the reason why broadcasters are looking for reliable and real-time and hopefully maybe some quality of service controlled IP connectivity, wireless IP connectivity, is to go do remote broadcasts of a good quality or even a high quality out in certain locations. I guess news gathering, Chris, is that what your station is looking for?
Yes. Yeah, we're looking at it for news gathering, but also the FM music stations that I work with, we're looking at doing music events as well.
Mm. Tom, how about your stations in Buckley Broadcasting, especially WOR in New York?
Well, WOR in New York, we still do a lot of long-form remote broadcasting, not necessarily with the morning show, but with our midday lady, Joan Hamburg. She goes out to a lot of shopping places and a lot of other areas, and we've been finding it, you know, increasingly difficult to get ISDN service, and when you do get the service, the phone company really, you know, the texts they send out don't know anymore how this stuff works and how to make it work. So we started with the IP stuff, and yeah, we're going to be going with a hardwired IP. Friday we're using hardwired IP over at Rutgers Stadium for a 3-hour pregame show we're doing for the local station, and it's actually worked out well for us. It'd be nice if the LTE service or the WiMAX service when it comes out, if it is what they say, because right now with the cellular modems, we tried one on cellular modem a couple of weeks ago, and boy, let me tell you, it fell apart. It was awful. Oh, mm-hmm. Man.
And all these technologies, whether it's LTE, WiMAX, or even just normal EVDO sorts of services, these are only as good as whatever the weakest link is in the system. I know that many cell towers just have a T1 connection going to them, which is going to be limited to 1.5 megabits per second.
And if they get a lot of either phone calls or a lot of data calls on that site, there's going to be a problem.
Right. Chris Tarr, how about in Milwaukee? Are you hearing anything about wireless IP services there?
Well, see, it's kind of a love-hate thing around here. And, you know, with New York being such a large market, when they do these build-outs, they plan for a whole lot of capacity. Now, in these medium-sized markets, especially in the Midwest, they don't want to overbuild. So typically what they do is they underbuild. And although we get these things, you know, I have nightmares of the audio choking because of lack of bandwidth and things like that. As soon as, you know, we get into drive time in the morning and the afternoon when lots of people are using data plans and cell phones and things like that, that's typically been our experience when they've lit up 3G networks as well. It's a very kind of a confined area. And when they build them out, they don't put a lot of bandwidth there to support it. They turn it on and it works great on the weekends and in the middle of the day, and then it just gets choked in the morning and the afternoon. So, you know, that's going to be one of those things that I'm going to be looking out for, because like everyone else, you know, we've been using POTS lines and things like that. And, you know, so far, our incumbent carrier, which is SBC, they're pretty good about things like ISDN still. I know in some markets like Verizon, you can't get ISDN anymore. So we're still kind of stuck there, and I'd love to go on to wireless. But that's my biggest fear, is you get into morning and afternoon drive time when everybody's on the freeway and there's the traffic jams, and that bandwidth goes away.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Chris, about a year and a half ago, I had a chance to try Clearwire's WiMAX service here in Nashville. Nashville is one of the first four markets that Clearwire came into. And, of course, they probably had hardly any other subscribers at the time, but it worked fantastically. We used it with a Telos Zephyr IP, and it was just perfect. It was as good as a wired connection. I don't know that that'll be the case when if they sell the place out like a health club oversells capacity in the gym. We'll just have to wait and see. I wanted to mention that this technology HSPA Plus, this is what the GSM providers like AT&T and T-Mobile will be promoting. Right now in some markets we have HSDPA, which is the system that favors the download speed. That's not what broadcasters are looking for. Broadcasters are looking for a favorable upload speed from the remote site with the IP codec into the system. I would imagine, and maybe some of you know, HSPA Plus, do we know if that is symmetrical or if it's asymmetrical?
Most of these systems, so technologies, are being built with asymmetry.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of it has to do with the technology and the way they want to manage it, from what I've been hearing.
Well, actually, remember, if you look at it from their point of view, the Joe average consumer is more interested in downloading than he is uploading.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, for broadcasters, it's not necessarily bandwidth and speed. It's latency.
Yeah, it's the routing, the latency. The radio interface for these technologies is not designed for the quick real time.
Have you guys I've noticed this. Of course, my experience comes from the Telos side because that's my employer, Telos, Omnia, and Axia. But on the Zephyr IP product, there is a status page that lets you see the textual trace route of where your connection is going when you make an IP call from your location to wherever the studio is, say. And it also shows you graphically a map, an auto-sizing map of the U.S. or the world or wherever you are that shows you graphically where your connection is going to. I noticed that with wired connections, the map and the trace route tend to make sense. You tend to get kind of shortest routing. But whenever I'm using a wireless carrier, whether it's Sprint or Verizon, I've noticed this incredible routing all over back and forth across the U.S. several times. I've even had it go down to Rio de Janeiro and back to the U.S. Any idea why this routing is taking place like this? Seems like it's causing a lot of extra latency and unknown factors in the IP connection.
Well, you've got the wireless carrier's backbone to go through, and it all depends on where the traffic is and where they're going to route it before it gets to the internet.
Is this maybe a case of, instead of least efficient routing, it's least cost routing?
I don't know if it's least cost routing as much as I think the way the phone companies work. They take a lot of their old-style hub-and-spoke approach of the days of the tandem switch offices, and a lot of their IP backbone is set up in the same manner. For example, here in New York City, the Verizon wireless network has two or three data pops that actually exist in New Jersey, South Jersey, and actually serve Philadelphia and New York City, depending on which part of Jersey and New York City you're in. Why they do it that way, I don't know. So you can actually be in Camden, New Jersey, being served by a POP that controls New York City as well as South Jersey. The engineers explained to me that they do this for their internal tariffed handoffs, because Verizon Wireless is a retail tariff compared to the wired line internet providers. So they cannot coexist in the same places. It's a very convoluted.
The laws that we have got to be convoluted about that. Older technologies and how
exactly
they're tariffed, and newer technologies and how they're not. We could spend some more time on this, but let's see what news comes along, and you guys keep me up to date when news comes along about this. Obviously, broadcasters are looking for reliable, consistent latency in IP connectivity, so we could do more broadcasts from more places. Tom Ray, you were interested in talking about this ratcheting clause with the FCC's rules concerning AM radio stations.
Because we just built a new site about 3 years ago and put it on the air.
This is called the Dawson Iraq. They're looking to ditch this ratcheting clause. Tell us a little bit about what this clause is and how this applies to AM radio stations and they're wanting to make improvements to their coverage area.
Well, what the ratchet clause is, it's the FCC's attempt to clean up the AM band. And what they're saying is that if you make a major modification to your facility, in the case of WOR, we moved the transmitter site about two-thirds of a mile to the north, because the area where we were located was being redeveloped. When that happens, they say, okay, well, behind the antenna where the null is, you have to pull that back, you have to pull that in, the backside in, by 10%. Well, if you take a look at the WOR signal, it looks kind of like a lopsided figure eight, with the top of the eight pointing towards New York City and Long Island, the bottom of the eight pointing directly towards Philadelphia, and then up to the north-northwest, there's this big notch. In the 1960s, when the original antenna was built in northern New Jersey, it made a lot of sense to have that notch there. There wasn't a heck of a lot in northwestern Jersey or in southern New York State, Orange County, where I live. You take a look at today, you can't buy a house in most of those areas because there's no place to put a house. And there's a whole big group of people that we can't serve because of the null in our signal. And over the years, even though WOR is a Class 1B signal, which means that we're one of the primaries on, it's a clear channel, what used to be called a clear channel frequency, and we're a primary station. Even though, and we went with a directional antenna initially because we wanted to cover New York and have the best signal as possible over Long Island, so we directionalized. We didn't have to, but we did. And in doing so, that allowed a station in Niagara Falls, Canada, to sneak in on 710 kilohertz. And the problem is that when we started building this antenna, the FCC wanted us to notch it down 10%. And boy, let me tell you, you wouldn't have been able to hear us in Paramus, New Jersey, 10 miles away. The good news about this whole thing was that because WOR is the 1B, and even though technically we protect Niagara Falls, we don't have to protect Niagara Falls because we're the dominant station, we're the primary. So the FCC actually allowed us to pull it back out to just about where it was before we started. But a lot of stations, they're going to get caught with this. And it's not making any difference on the AM band. You know, when you're taking a look at the man-made noise that's there and the noise from, let's say, compact fluorescent lights, from LED traffic lights, from bad ballasts in the sodium vapor street lights, it doesn't make a whole hill of beans if you pull this signal in or not. There's just too much man-made noise out there. This isn't the 1950s anymore.
Okay.
And I think it's a good idea, and that's what Dawson and Rackley are trying to prove to the commission is that, look, guys, it's a nice thought, but not practical in the year 2009.
Did I get the sense that the commission is seriously considering this and realizing that what they tried to do or the method they tried to clean up the AM band some years ago is ending up not having that effect properly, and so they should go ahead and get rid of this rule?
Well, I think Dawson and Rackley, as anything with the FCC, as any broadcasters listening know, you have to bring it to the commission. You have to prove to them why or why not this has to happen. And Dawson and Rackley right now are putting together their report and their study to go to the commission and say, look, guys, good idea, not working. We need you to rescind it. So I don't think the FCC has taken a position on it yet. This is just Dawson and Rackley trying to do this, and as someone who was affected by this, I think it's a good idea to get rid of it because it didn't do a hill of beans for anybody behind us.
Gotcha. Well, let us know if what happens about this, and if this is going to help AM broadcasters when they want to make changes to their facilities.
Yeah. Well. The other thing this ratchet clause did too is if a station wants to, let's say, if they get a power increase, that's considered a major, major construction. So it's a major change. And you, with this power change, you may be serving your area much better. But now the FCC says, oh, well, you made a big change. You got to notch in, from the null side, you got to notch it in 10%. Well, okay, you gained on one side and you lost on the other. So what did you really gain?
It becomes a zero-sum game.
Right, especially if you have a population on either side of that antenna. And now all of a sudden, to favor the left side, you got to pull from the right side, and it just doesn't work.
Got you. All right. Chris Tarr, you were just at the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association, yeah?
Yes, another great one, actually.
Is it still going on, or is it finished now?
It is. They do it's a 3-day event, and mm-hmm. the first 2 days are, day one is mostly is all radio. Day two is kind of radio, some TV, and then day three is TV. So I went to day one and two, which is yesterday and today.
Ah, okay. All right. What did you hear or see of anything particularly interesting?
I'll tell you what. I'm a much bigger fan of Frank Foti than I was before, and I was a pretty big fan.
We'll have Frank on a future show. Also, one of his R&D guys, Cornelius Gould, we'll have on too. But did you hear what Frank had to say today?
I did. And what he was talking about is how processors are going into the future and some of the things that he has found in some research recently on IMD, intermodulation distortion, and how with aggressive processing, which we all know Frank is pretty well known for, played some samples.
Yeah, right.
played these samples, and you could hear some of the popcorn and the static and things. And he's been playing around with different algorithms and different code and different ways of doing things to filter that out. And, all that aside, one of the things that I walked away from is if everybody in this business had a tenth the passion that Frank does, we'd be in a whole lot better shape than we are today. He got done, and the audience just kind of sat there for a minute soaking it in. Because we ended up after talking about, what's coming up in the Omnias and that sort of thing. He then went on, we kind of had a discussion, about where processing is now, where it's going, and, some of the ways people do things. And just the enthusiasm from him about the business and where we're going and where we've been is contagious. But I'm excited because, as a guy who does generate quite a bit of square wave, the idea here that we can continue to be loud yet have the cake and eat it too, the loud and the clean, is a real interesting concept, I think.
This you mentioned, Chris, IMD, and we'll mention this for the audience. IMD, intermodulation distortion, and this occurs in all kinds of electronic systems. In this case, we're talking about audio processing, in which we're trying to reduce the peaks and increase the average, and make audio sound not just louder, but in enhance it so that it's audible easily in loud listening environments. If if you're at the house and the wash machine is going and the vacuum cleaner is going, or the cat's meowing or the kid's crying, you can still hear what you want to hear over these things. And you're right. One of the problems is any audio processor represents a nonlinear a circuit, and so we know that as engineers, when we take two different signals and combine them in a nonlinear circuit, we end up with other products, things that we didn't necessarily want to have. This applies at the RF level when you have multiple transmitters at a site, and at the audio level as well. So you're saying Frank was talking about some new methods to reduce or eliminate this IMD. Is that right?
That's right. And it's, as I was listening to this and listening to the clips of audio as he was putting it through different sorts of aggressive processing, it did remind me of a line I love from Bob Orban, which is, radio is one of the only businesses where we purposely take the product and destroy it before delivering it. And, so it's good that we're actually looking at this. And, for many, many years, it's always been about that signature sound, louder, louder, louder. And, try to get as clean as you can, but really loud is the big thing. So it's interesting now to see that we're, the processing horsepower has gotten good enough and cheap enough that we're able to look at the problem on a much larger scale, which I think is great. So that was one of the great sessions that we had here at the Broadcasters Clinic. Another one was an introduction to kind of an overview of the AM method of moments. And another, and unfortunately, as you know, it's so complex that you really can't do anything more than kind of scratch the surface on this in the time that was allotted, which is about an hour. But I thought that was real fascinating and something that I really am trying to get my head around. And Tom probably is a better guy to talk about method of moments. But if you have a directional system or planning on building a directional system, this really changes the rules a little bit and how you do it. And some people have said just cuts massive amount of time off of designing and building these directional arrays.
Oh yeah, because when you build the directional array, the traditional method of doing that is you go out and you have to do measurements out to about 20 miles, and in some cases, and Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, but in the case of 10-10 winds, you guys would go out to 40 miles, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct. Yes,
and
time-consuming.
That takes a lot of time, and what happens typically, especially in an area like the New Jersey Meadowlands, where you have a lot of high tension towers, you've got the New Jersey Turnpike, you've got a lot of elevated roadways, you get what's called re-radiation, which may or may not, depending on the measurement area and depending on the person making the measurement, may or may not actually be a problem, and it could show your pattern as being out when it's not, and in doing all this, doing it moment of methods, you set it up according to the computer model, and you're finished. You actually go out and make a couple of measurement points for reference, but it's only a couple, as opposed to spending weeks out in the field tuning one of these up. Because let's say you have a null direction, a direction of minimal signal. You may spend several weeks going out. You go out, you measure, you come back, you adjust. You go out, you measure, you come back, you adjust. And it can be a royal pain and very time-consuming and extremely expensive because of the manpower involved in tuning up a directional array.
I guess the manpower, you can have a number of engineers with expensive meters out there and cell phones or two-way radios all waiting for some adjustments to be made and see what the measurements are, right?
And typically when these happen, it's August and there's lots of mosquitoes around and people driving fast along the highway, and that's typically the way it works. Yeah.
Or in the case of New Jersey, where people just are suspicious by nature. I mean, I've had the cops called on me. I've had dogs sent after me. It's unbelievable.
I have monitor points at 10-10 winds that are in cemeteries, and it's just it makes for an interesting time with the local police.
Chris Tarr, this method of moments, I've read about this for a few years and don't understand it, but it seems to me we're talking about a way that is approved by the FCC to predict the coverage pattern of a directional AM radio station that's good enough to where it can be certified without having to go take all these measurements. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, in a nutshell, that's exactly what it is. And the software has been developed enough now where it's fairly accurate. And you really, it all revolves around, when you build this, building it and building it within some pretty tight tolerances, so that what reality, what you see in reality matches what the computer predicts. One of the interesting conversations we had about that was in days past, when you were using the traditional method of designing directional arrays, if you made a change, for example, you put an FM bay up there, or you would do a partial proof. Now, the difference with method of moments, and one of the things you need to think about when you're deciding what method you want to choose, is from what we're at least gathering now, you start all over again with designing the array on the computer if you make any significant changes. And I think, Tom, you probably know a little bit more about this, but that's kind of what I'm gathering is what happens here. If you need to make any kind of modification that would trigger a partial proof, in method of moments, there's no such thing as a partial calculation. You really have to do the whole thing over.
Right. You have to go back in. You have to take a look at the entire system, and you have to go back and redo the computer model, see what, if anything, has changed, and readjust the array accordingly. But the good news is you don't have to go out and do all these measurements.
Before we give a call to Gary Klein, our guest, does anyone have a favorite story about AM field readings that they'd like to share with the audience?
Oh, my God.
I guess so, huh?
Where does one begin?
Yeah, I said there was the one where I'm out in the swamp in August with the massive Wisconsin state bird, better known as the mosquito, flying around. And then there are some others where there were some, not so decent areas of town where I had to do these monitor points. And, I'd literally roll the window down and, while the car's still sort of rolling, throw the field meter out, take the reading, bring it back in, roll up the window, and speed off, because people come out, wondering what's going on, and they're not looking like you belong in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
I think we all have at least one monitor point in some neighborhood of that type.
Yeah, they're lovely places, let me tell you.
Chris, Chris Tobin, what's a particularly striking memory of yours of a monitor point or a field reading?
Monitor point field reading would be one that was located literally on top of a rock. on the corner of a person's property that they built around over the time. And the owners changed. So the woman who was there for like 50 years knew to expect the engineer from the radio station every month to come out. She'd bring out coffee, donuts. It was very nice. So me being the young apprentice, I'm brought out by the chief. He says, okay, let me take you out. Here's what we do. Just remember it's so-and-so, and you just got to say hello. You have to sit a little bit, talk, say hi, and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, really? Okay. Sure enough, it was like a scene out of a movie. We come out, pull up, take the reading on top of the rock, which has a little square cut into it by a chisel, and then the lady comes out. Hello, gentlemen. And there we are for about an hour, sitting and having lemonade and donuts. I was just like, wow. This is, Connecticut. This is in Connecticut, Fairfield County, Connecticut, very, urban area, part of Norwalk. And I'm like, okay, interesting. And then on the flip side of that, the opposite side where the other monitor point was in a cemetery, which, as you can imagine, is desolate, except for a person like me with a meter out there with the FIM on top of a tombstone and a cop coming by and says, can I help you? I said, oh, yeah, I'm just doing this. He goes, no, can I help you? What is this? I'm like, here are my credentials. Here's what I'm doing. Okay, sir, you'll have to step aside, place that device on the floor, and now step to the vehicle with your hands spread. I'm like,
No,
you don't understand. I'm doing it was the best. Novice, I'm starting out. This is way back before all the security issues of the day, and I'm like, wow, this is how I'm going to spend my month. This is good.
I gotta tell you, though, I love cemeteries for monitor points because they never change.
Oh, yeah, the people don't go anywhere.
Right.
Tom Ray, how about you?
Oh, Lord, when we, with the old WR antenna array, one of the other, we're surrounded by three other AM directionals, and we can all interact, and one of the directionals, 1190 WLIB, made a change in their system. They put up two new towers, so we had to make some adjustments at WOR, so I went out to this one place, to one of the monitor points, and discovered that the bridge right next to where the monitor point was covered. Well, the state was adding more steel to it, and let me tell you, the reading was sky high. So we went out and did what's called the partial proof and proved it was okay. So I filed with the commission for a temporary monitor point, and I went out and I measured this point several times, and I made some adjustments to make sure it was going to do exactly what it had to do if something changed. And I was measuring it in the middle of a street. It's this little tiny side street in Rutherford, New Jersey. And this guy comes out. He's in the house. He sees me there. I'm back about three or four times. He comes out. What are you doing? Well, I'm handing him my business card. I'm with WOR. I'm making measurements. Get out of here. He says, don't think so. You're interfering with my house. Says, I'm not doing anything with your house. I'm on public street. I'm going to call the cops. I said, man, knock yourself out. He did. Cops showed up. Guy says, guy comes out. Cop says, what are you doing? I handed him my card, told him what I was doing. He's, oh, yeah, I listen to the morning show, John Gambling and such. He looks at the guy. He says to the guy, he says, what's your problem with this guy? He's not bothering you. Guy says, well, he's out here. He's on my property. Cop said, he's on a public road. And the cop kind of looked at me, and I said to the cop, I says, maybe he thinks I'm from the cable company, and he's stealing cable TV. The guy cursed and disappeared into the house.
Now, Tom, that makes sense when I think about my story of reading of taking a station's reading in front of somebody's house, and I was on the street, not even on their sidewalk, and a lady comes out, and she's dressed in something, some old 30-year-old flannel outfit, and the little slippers with the fuzzy balls on them. And she accuses me of monitoring whatever she's watching on TV.
Do you have any tin foil in the house, ma'am?
No. Right. I mean, we suggest you apply liberally.
Yeah. Let's tell you what. It's let's bring Gary Klein in. Let me see if we can add him to the conference. Let's see.
Ooh, one ring ding.
Ringing. That's a good sign.
Maybe
hello.
Hey, is this Gary Klein?
It is.
Good. Did we catch you at a good time, Gary?
Sure.
All right. We're on the all on a conference here with Chris Tobin, Chris Tarr from Milwaukee, and also Tom Ray from New York. I think you know at least two out of three of those.
Hey, Gary.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, guys.
Hello, Gary.
Well, Gary, I want to first of all congratulate you on. I introduced you earlier in the show before we got you on. You're the vice president of engineering and information technology with Cumulus Media. I met Gary years ago in Indianapolis on the top of a building in downtown Indianapolis. Gary, was that WHHH?
It was. It was WHHH, which is now owned by Radio 1, but back then was owned by Bill Shirk, and we met in the cover of darkness at the bank, what at the time was the Bank One building. I think it's probably called the Chase building now, but we met there almost in the middle of the night. The top of that new building.
Seems like it was even raining that night, and I was hired to come do some warranty work on a transmitter that you had there.
That's right. I think you did. I think you drove over from Nashville or something. I remember pulling some equipment out of the back of your car, and we went up that tall building through elevators and stairs and did some work.
Well, Gary, you've had
this day.
You've had. I mean, you were doing a lot then, but you have had quite a career since then. And now you've just recently received this award from Radio World. It's their Excellence in Engineering Award. Is this something that they award every year?
It is something they award every year. Now, I think this may be. I may be wrong about this, but it's either the fifth, maybe the fifth year they've done it. They've only done it for a short period of time, and. Ironically, the first engineer to get it, and this was given away in Vegas at the NAB show in Vegas, was Andy Andreessen, who was a Cumulus engineer at the time. He still works for Cumulus. And so ironically, the very first award went to a Cumulus engineer, and now four or five awards later, Jeff Littlejohn won it last year. Clay Feinrub won it maybe the year before him. Another Cumulus engineer won it. So it was quite an honor. It was also a little bit of a surprise and a shock because it was the last thing on my mind when I got the phone call that day. You know, wake up in the morning and think to yourself, you know, any day now, I bet they'll be awarding that award, and hey, maybe it'll be me, and I'll be getting that phone call. So it was a very nice honor and quite a surprise.
Well, you know, Gary, it's well-deserved, and it couldn't have gone to a nicer and a better guy.
Yeah, I'd have
I
to
appreciate it. That's very nice of you to say that.
I'd second that. There's certainly nobody that works harder and has more cell phones and keeps track of more things than Gary Klein. Gary, I guess what I'd like to ask you is, what in terms of broadcast engineering, radio engineering specifically, what is really on your mind these days? What do you spend your time working on or hoping for or dreaming about in terms of our profession?
Well, I think that's a great question, and I guess I break it up in a sort of, I guess I would call it two categories. One, what is on my mind with the day-to-day normal tasks that I cover? In other words, if you covered that category and you say, well, what's on your mind today? And I answered with that funnel, I would talk about various transmitter and antenna projects and upgrades and signals and move-ins and studio projects and IT projects at corporate and all sorts of initiatives and things that we're working on in the company. I would answer that. And I can always get into detail with that with you. And then if you ask me about the other category or call it bucket, and I call that bucket the bucket of what am I dreaming about? What about new technology? You know, what am I thinking about 4 years from now or as I dream. That's another bucket or category. And if you asked me that and I answered with that funnel, I would talk about the ways that I'm trying to re-engineer how we do engineering in our company. Frankly, I hope some other people in the industry, take note of some of the things that we're doing, much like I take note of how other people are, in their own respective, companies and careers are making changes for the better. There was an article recently in Radio World, in fact, in the same Radio World issue that came out the other week that had the article about my award in it. There was an article about how Cumulus and Gap are sharing engineers. So there are things along those lines that I dream about, and that in certain instances, like the Gap sharing arrangement, I'm actually executing. And there are other things that I'm working on, new designs of technology and, for instance, automation software, ways of using virtualization technology such that 7 radio stations in a cluster can all run off one server, using virtual technology to run all of their automation, ways to cut expenses, that's one of them, ways to better connect our facilities and monitor our sites and our transmitters, ideas I have about how I want to create the virtual SWAT engineer, maybe 8 or 9 or 10 guys in our company that have every piece of test gear you can imagine, that have vans, that have every piece and part you could possibly imagine that is commonly needed, that are guys that roam from, market to market, taking care of facilities to sort of supplement, the markets where we don't have either the talent or the money or the budget for the equipment so we can better maintain and monitor all of our facilities. I'm thinking about ways to, increase bandwidth and connectivity between our markets as we convert more of our platforms to call it .NET technology. At Cumulus now, our music scheduling system and our traffic and billing system are all .NET technology. They do not run on servers or clients in each market. They run on web browsers, and everything's centrally located in Atlanta. That was sort of a dream we had maybe 4 years ago, which now in the last 3 years we've executed throughout the company. Not one of our radio stations uses Selector to schedule music, and as of a couple of weeks ago, not one of our stations uses Darts or, you know, what is it, not data count, but CBSI as an example, or Marketron. Not one of our stations uses those software applications anymore to run traffic. We run our own software. So I look at things in two buckets, and those are the things that are on my, you know, those are the things that go through my mind, and those are the things that I try to execute. Not to mention digital strategy. You know, where are we at with the iPhone app? Where are we at with new technology, SIP technology? I'm thinking of ways to pump phone calls into radio stations using Skype and SIP technology built into browsers on your web. So when you're streaming our station, not only are you having a listen to our audio and a player in your window on your laptop or your mobile device, but there's a button you click that actually connects you to our DJ in the studio so that you can talk real time. No more, you know, be the ninth caller to you know, 555-1212. Now it's just click on a button and you're in the queue. I'm thinking of things like that and how we can put those things into operation in our company. Since I, you know, have some involvement, to say the least, in both engineering and IT, because when those departments are merged in our company, at the top, we can make things happen, you know, rather quickly and efficiently. I don't have to think and pray and hope that the separate IT director might work with me on a particular project. You know, we don't have to work that way in our company. So those are some of the things that we're, you know, that I think about. There's plenty more. That's just sort of an example of what goes through my mind.
Those sound like some pretty out of the box ideas there.
You know, Steve Davis or Jeff Littlejohn or Andy Larry Journal or you know, Dave Run or companies, they may have some similar ideas as well. They probably do. But those are some of the things that I'm involved with. Again, not to mention all day-to-day stuff like software day-to-day thinking, their discussion. And last week,
I think Gary has moved from one cell site to another and no longer...
And didn't make the change. With it. Well.
Yeah, didn't make the change.
Wasn't a very soft handoff.
No, it wasn't. We'll call him... happened to me.
What were we talking about, WiMAX and LTE?
I was just going to say, it's going to fix that, isn't it? Yeah, no more of that.
In our dreams.
we'll call Gary back in just a second. Tell you what, guys, while Gary's not on, what couple of questions you want to ask Gary about? I'm thinking PPM, personal people meter, and this HD radio power increase. What else do you think we ought to ask Gary about?
Well, I'm curious with the economy the way it is, and he mentioned the Gap engineering sharing agreement. How else this has affected you know, his department and his area of the company? With
I would be curious also.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, let's see if we can get Gary back on here.
Where's Ernestine when you need her?
It's unusual.
One dingy.
Unusual to find Gary when he's not traveling.
Guys there?
Hey, are you there?
Yeah, sorry, I lost you. I also dream about how to get more cell sites along I-70, but apparently, I'm sorry, guys, but I don't know if you lost me or not when I was just talking about the fact that I think about and I deal with every day on the normal stuff that all of us on this call deal with. Transmitters off the air, you know, network problems in the building. You know, they usually bubble up to me when they get real serious. Antenna burnouts. You know, transmitter problems, you know, serious problems that need extra assistance. I also get those phone calls, and I talk about them, you know, but that kind of leads into some of the things I dream about how to get, you know, the SWAT engineers set up and to get better response time to our markets and to give people more of the tools that they need. You know, those are everyday things that turn into the things I dream about how to do. It's a little different when you have five stations or you have 370 like we do at Cumulus. It's not as simple as saying, well, I'll just send a $25,000 spectrum analyzer to every single engineer so they have one, because I think they ought to have one. I mean, I do think they ought to have one, but it becomes very costly to do that. So you have to find, you know, new ways of implementing fast response time with good technology. Those are things I think about.
We were wondering, Gary, with the economic turndown that we've had during this year of 2009, and I know Cumulus took some pretty drastic steps, maybe other broadcasters did too, where we had some extended vacations, we had some days without pay and things of that nature. How, in your position in leading engineering in the company, how have you addressed a tighter budget and economic downturn? Engineer sharing was one of those things you mentioned with Gap broadcasting in a particular market. Has this been particularly gut-wrenching for you, difficult? Tell me about this, this economic difficulty and how it's affecting you.
Well, yeah, I think that's another great question. And, I mean, I'd be lying if I said that I don't think about that and that I wish the economic times weren't what they were, and especially what they are in the media business, whether it's radio or TV or newspaper. I think newspaper has it worse than radio from everything I'm told and that I read. I'm sure you read the same trades. We've heard about so many newspapers shutting down. And I really wish it wasn't that way. So in that respect, it is gut-wrenching because all of us on this call, I'm sure, remember the radio industry back in the 80s and maybe the 70s and certainly the early and mid-90s and what things were like then. And to the extent that I'm a radio guy through and through, been doing this 27 years, to that extent, just in general, yeah, it's gut-wrenching because I don't like to see it. I don't like to see people losing their jobs, whether it's the programming or news department or the sales department or it's an engineering department change. I don't like to see that at all. But at the same time, we have weathered pretty well at Cumulus. For instance, in engineering, I've had very little staff reduction across the board in the company. We did do some sharing arrangements with Gap. But at the same time, the guys, the couple of markets in Cumulus where we shared with Gap, and it was maybe their engineer that we were hiring to help the Cumulus stations. We may have elected not to do business anymore with a contract engineer. I didn't actually fire, for instance, a full time engineering employee to make that deal occur. It was affected contract labor on the Cumulus side, and there may have been, I don't remember off the top of my head, just a couple of markets where maybe we went from, you know, I think of one market, I think in San Francisco, we may have dropped from, three engineers to, or I think from four engineers to three engineers, okay? We still have two engineers and an IT guy there. We dropped from four to three. That's workable. What we didn't do is drop from four engineers to a contract guy, you know? So those were workable on the staffing and employment side. And you mentioned a minute ago that some companies took vacations or extended vacations. I don't know if you use the word furlough, but at Cumulus, what we did is we took 1 week for the entire year of 2009 so far to date. We had 1 week of furlough we were all required to take right up through the CEO, and each of us got a week off. It was kind of like an unpaid vacation. We got an extra week of vacation, but we weren't paid for it. That, I guess, fair to say, probably wasn't pleasant for some people. But as I told my guys, and I personally believe this, I think it's better than what other companies did. You may have read Bonneville did this. I forget the other radio companies that made these. Radio One did something along these lines. But some of these other companies may have taken furloughs. Some, I think Citadel did this. Didn't we read that Citadel did this? They gave their employees maybe get a 5% pay cut or something along those lines, depending on what level of pay you are at. Bonneville, I saw in the trades the other week, did that, and some other companies did maybe Emmis. I think Emmis did that as well. At Cumulus, we didn't give a straight across the board pay cut. We asked everybody to take 1 week less of pay, and they got a week off. And as far as full time employees go, and I think part time employees did that as well. The salespeople were exempt, so the account execs did not have to do that. Well, I prefer 1 week off than having a standardized pay cut that applies to everybody and applies for the rest of your, perhaps the rest of your career or the rest of the year or the next couple of years. So while it wasn't, something I guess any of us would like, it was 1 week of a small amount of pain, if you will, for some, and then life goes on. And if I couple that along with the fact that I didn't have to cut staff to any real measurable amount, given the size of the staff of engineering we have in the company, I think we came out pretty, unscathed, and I'm very, very happy. about that on the staffing side, and I think most of our engineers realize that that's okay. You didn't really ask it, but I will. I don't think you asked this question, but one of the questions that comes to mind when you talk about furlough, how the heck did your stations get along with guys taking a week off? I mean, geez, you know, transmitters could go off the air. Were your stations well maintained? We had a plan of action. One, we staggered when people took their week. We made sure that, for instance, in Iowa, where I have stations in Cedar Rapids and Waterloo and Quad Cities, and even Rockford nearby, Rockford, Illinois, we made sure that the guys staggered what they did so that we didn't have all four guys taking the same week off. So if somebody went off the air, another guy could drive an hour or maybe 90 minutes and get to another station and help them out. We all helped each other out. And remember, as a normal course of doing business, I'm sure all of us on this call that are engineers or radio stations have a backup plan when you go on vacation or get sick, whether it's another engineer in your facility or another engineer in your market is backup. All of our guys in our company have that in place where we back each other up. And so really we asked our guys to invoke that plan. Pretend you're going away for a week on your normal vacation. What would you do? You certainly have some backup, don't you? And that's another way that we supplemented the time that they took off. On the other side of the equation, when it comes to tight budgets, when you ask about in a tight economic situation, you're talking about two types of budgets, right? You're talking about operating expense, my tower painting and my buying of batteries and power tubes for my transmitter, and then there's capital, my mic processing, my new MARTI unit, my new transmitter, my new automation system, my new air conditioning unit, whatever it happens to be, there's capital. And on operating budgets, you know, at Cumulus, we've always run, I would say, lean and efficient and smart. So in tight economic times, we took a harder look at what we were spending, but it wasn't like we took the budget and we could just cut it by 75% or 60% or 55% or 50% and say, aha, now we're conforming to tight economic times. We always ran very tight. All we did was take an extra hard look during budgeting season to ask people for sure, do you need that? Are you sure you need that tube? Did you buy a tube in the last year? Are you putting that tube in the budget for a good measure? Or you've already gone 14 months, or will have gone 14 months next year's budget, and you know you're probably going to need one based on history. Tower painting. When's the last time you painted that tower? Do you have a paint chart? Are you sure you're out of compliance? Tensioning. Is that a routine tensioning that you do every year that isn't absolutely necessary, or is that something that's been way out of whack? Or you've had a recent tower crew on the tower to relamp, and they told you, you better get this tensioned soon because we notice a problem, we're experts in this field, and here's a report, you need attention. Because in those instances, obviously, we're going to take care of things. We made sure that we left money in the budget for all of the important things that you routinely need to do, for instance, tubes and tower lamping and, you know, shrubbery and other needed items, and we made sure to question those items that you ought to question to make sure it was going to absolutely be needed. And by the way, I always tell my guys this, if we didn't put something in the budget and you need it, and it's a matter of business to keep you on the air or to save you from losing revenue, then we'll give you what we call a variance and we'll get it. For instance, if you don't budget for a tube because you didn't think you're going to need the tube, or we questioned you and you said, you know, I could probably get another year out of it, I don't know, but I think so, and it turns out you couldn't, it's not like we're going to say in November, you know, you just didn't budget for it. So the transmitter will have to drop to 40 or 50% power and be illegal and go against the FCC rules, and you'll go off the air, and that's just too bad at some point when the tube finally just craps out on you. We don't do that at Cumulus. So even if it isn't in the budget, but it turns out it's needed, then, you know, ultimately we do it. I mean, if your air conditioner or your boiler in the winter, you know, breaks and you need another $3,000 to repair it, and it wasn't budgeted for because we just didn't know it was going to break, we make sure that the guys get that money. So economic times aside, you know, you're going to get the things that you need to operate in your budget. And if you don't get them, we're going to give you a variance if it's absolutely needed. But on the other hand, if there are some things we can hold off on that aren't absolutely necessary, probably we're going to ask you to do that. And I think that's a fair thing to do on capital. We've always worked with Cumulus, what we call CapEx, capital exception. Unlike some other companies, we don't plan in advance all of the items you're going to need the following year. Some companies have people prepare a list, and then they approve certain things, and they say, yep, you're scheduled for that new MARTI unit or a mast for the van or server for the rack room, you know, in September. You're scheduled, and in September you can go buy it. We don't do that at Cumulus with just a few exceptions. A Cumulus is capital exception. If you need something, you ask for it, and then we will consider that and then we may or may not approve it. The good news about that system is you can ask at any time for anything you want, and you have a shot at getting it. You don't have to say, well, I'll have to wait till next year because the capital budget's already been approved for this year, and, you know, we can't get something in third quarter because, well, it just wasn't approved last year and we didn't turn in. So you can ask for something whenever you want. Doesn't mean you're going to get it. But most reasonable requests at Cumulus, economic times included, are approved. Most reasonable requests. Things that aren't absolutely needed or that can be put off, well, there's a chance that we may ask you to wait on those things too, just like the operating budget. But I can tell you that a lot of people have gotten, you know, the things that they've needed this year because I approve pretty much all of that. The exception to our capital system in terms of asking for when you need them are really big items like a studio build-out. We built a new studio in Cincinnati this year. We know in advance we're going to do that. We may allocate money in advance to make sure there's enough money to do that in advance of the budget, you know, of the following budget year. But that's for major, major items, a major transmitter site build-out, a major build-out. We're going to know about that and sort of block aside special funds for those things. So there are a few exceptions. But other than that, the routine capital items that you ask for, well, we call that CapEx, capital exception. So I guess that's my answer to how we've dealt with it. A little bit of pain, but, you know, like everybody in business will tell you in any industry, that because all industries are suffering, right? They're going to tell you, look, spending is down, but there were things that we need to do and we will continue to do them. Much like companies such as Kellos or companies such as Harris or companies like Wheatstone or companies like Dielectric or Shively. It's not like they are not getting one single order this year because nobody's spending anything. I talk to these guys all the time and judge their business climate as well as my own. And I know from talking to them that other companies as well as Cumulus are spending money. Not as much as the year before, not as much as 5 years ago perhaps, but definitely some things need to get done and some money is being spent. So not at the end of the world.
Gary, speaking of spending big money, we just have a few minutes left, but tell me your thoughts about the state of HD radio at this point and where are we going with HD radio?
Well, you know, that's the question is sort of simple, and there's probably a simple answer to that. I think I'll try to give you an overview, but obviously, as all of you on the call know, it's more complicated. I mean, HD radio has come a long way in the last 5 years. I mean, I read today in the trades, like you probably did, Volvo's making it standard, okay? It's pretty much, it's either standard or almost in every model that BMW has. And nearly, pretty much any automaker you or I can mention has got it in their car. I read Audi in 2010 is going to have it, I think, as standard, which is great because I like Audis myself personally. And they've just made incredible headway. Great headway, as you know, in the portable device market. I wasn't really a big fan of cable radios. It seemed like every week another company was announcing a cable radio, but, you know, I never really got excited about that. But when you read, you know, in the trades today, that it's rumored that Apple's going to have FM radios and they're going to have software update that's going to turn it on the iPhone, and at some point you can figure the next jump will be to have, you know, digital radio on an iPhone. When you visit the trade shows and you read the blogs and you realize there's probably going to be an HD radio adapter for iPhones and iPods, a little plug-in device that goes on the bottom when you read or hear the rumors about those things, so you know that it's going to come, and that could happen maybe this year. When you look at the Zune, when you look at the Insignia device that, you know, you can buy at Best Buy for $49 for the entire radio, when you look at that, it gets real exciting. And I think, I don't know if we've turned the corner yet. I mean, some people will say we have, but I definitely think that we're getting to what they call critical mass, where it's a point now where, you know, in the early days, I'd ask my guys, you probably ask your guys, hey, do you ever have the HD transmitter off? Yeah. Did anybody ever call in and complain when it was off the air? No. Today, when I ask my guys, when you turn the HD off for maintenance or for whatever reason, you know, maybe you have a technical problem, do people call or pay attention? More of my guys are telling me, yes, people are paying attention, and people do call in and ask us what happened when it's dying. And when you look at how many cars now and how many portable devices are being sold with HD radio in it, it's to the point where I think you have to take it seriously. In other words, how our audio sounds on the HD is important. The fact that your HD is up and running all the time is important. The fact that you're not playing the same looped log again and again, if that's happened to be what you were doing, is very important. So I think the state of HD radio is getting much more critical mass, more exciting, and I definitely think you're going to see more people converting to HD. Maybe not yet in the small markets because it's still a fairly, relatively speaking, expensive proposition. But I definitely think, you know, as you guys know, the top 100 markets is great saturation. And I think you're going to see more of that. I think you're going to see more conversions. And I think it's going to take, I think it's going to finally get to the point where people are talking about it. I have had talks with people that meet with the automakers regularly and talk technology with them. I hear that the automakers are really beginning to start to wonder whether satellite radio is here for the long haul. Based on their subscription rates, which are not that impressive, and based on the fact that there is, you know, financial trouble mentioned weekly about those companies, about the merged company, and who knows what's going to happen. And I think they're looking at other forms of technology. HD radio is something that they can put in a car that somebody doesn't have to subscribe to, and they're getting behind it. So I think it's starting to make more sense for people more than it ever has, and I'm excited about it. Are you going to see HD radio in every single car in the next year? No. Is this 5 or 10 years down the road before we have complete saturation and it's the standard and the norm and everybody is listening to HD? You know, maybe. I mean, you know, maybe it's going to take that long. It's not going to be the next year, but we've made great progress, and I think it's going to continue that way. I wish more AM stations would convert, but I realize some of the technical obstacles and cost obstacles to doing that. Some people, you know, have issue with the with what they say is interference. Some people are concerned about that. But you know, I think AM sounds great when it's an IBOC, and I think FM's better. I think the multicast channels for FM are really where I think a lot of people are headed and a lot of people are excited about, and where the revenue potential is. I think the power increase is certainly necessary. I'm glad to see that Ubiquiti and NPR are reaching a compromise. You know, I was one of the lucky people to be invited by NPR out to one of their tests back, I think it was in August. Stayed up till 6 in the morning with these guys all night with all their special test equipment and gear, doing one of these famous, you know, tests that they talk about, to be able to witness it and to give them my input and my comments. And so I think it's, you know, I think it's a good thing that they're going to do the power increase. I definitely think that's part of this equation in the mix. There are other new technologies that you may have read about, I'm sure you have, about how we can play with the carriers and change the levels at which the sidebands operate. And that may alleviate some concerns that people have. NPR said that that would obviously be something that they feel strongly about pursuing and pursuing quickly. So lots of other interesting technologies related to HD and improving the way that we broadcast HD that people at Harris and the other transmitter companies are working hard on in combination with Ubiquiti. So very good stuff out there. Those are my thoughts on HD.
About time to wrap this up. Chris Tobin, Chris Tarr, Tom Ray, do you have any questions for Gary?
God, no, not me. We covered just about everything.
You said it all.
Sure did.
Because you guys haven't said anything. You'd be quiet. You've had me talking the whole time. I feel terrible.
No, you know, we've been enjoying it and learning about things, you know?
I think you've answered questions before we asked them, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well,
yeah, you answered everything with passion.
Sorry about that. I didn't give you a chance. What's that?
I said you answered the questions with such passion. We didn't want you to stop.
I'm very passionate about this. I'm a diehard radio guy. I get... You know, I get, discouraged. I shouldn't say discouraged. I get maybe a little upset when I read some of the blogs that people write and the things people have to say about our industry, especially when they talk about engineering and how, you know, it's not what it used to be and this and that. I look at the other side or the glass that's half full, and I think that there's a lot of great, exciting technologies that we're dealing with. I've considered actually changing engineers in our company from chief engineer to something like media engineer. Because, frankly, guys, I hope you'll agree with me. I mean, we don't just deal with transmitters anymore, and we don't just deal with studios. We deal with IP. We deal with streaming. We deal, in some cases, with video streaming. We're dealing with HD radio and UDP and TCP/IP. Most of our STLs aren't composite as much as they are digital.
Some of our studios aren't even audio.
Exactly. You know, I mean, our studios, you know, we have IP and super data highways connecting all of our studios and facilities together. Our remotes now, many of them are done by IP or wireless IP with a 3G card. I mean, we're not just doing engineering. We're like media engineers. And I just think it's very exciting, the things in the times that we live in now. I'm very thankful that you know, when I took my first ham radio license, you know, I had to learn about grids and plates and tubes. But I'm glad I have that background. But I'm very, very happy to be living in a time where we're dealing with the technologies that we deal with now, with the fact that I can hold an iPhone in my hand and remote control, you know, through VNC, you know, half the devices on my radio station from almost anywhere in the world. It's exciting stuff, and I hope that the engineers that listen to this podcast, you know, do remain excited and do stay excited and not worry so much about the economic times, but just get involved with what you're doing in your station and get involved with the things that you're not involved with. Learn the things you don't know yet. If you're one of those RF guys that don't know a lot about the IT portion, learn more about it. If you're one of the IT guys that really doesn't know a lot about the transmitter and studio side, learn more about that. We need more guys in this business that know more of these things, so that we can become more efficient in our radio stations. The days of clusters having 8 engineers is dying, where each guy had his own responsibility, whether it was visiting the transmitter site or taking care of studios or simply just being the network administrator. It's so much more important now to be a guy who does things and fit into the more efficient, consolidated operation that radio stations are embracing. Okay,
you know, Gary,
Gary,
I think that makes the job more interesting for all of us when we're involved in a heck of a lot more than just the transmitter or just the studio or just a computer or whatever it is. You know, you're facing a different challenge every day. You're facing a different piece of equipment. You're facing a different set of circumstances all the time. And that, you know, at least for me, that keeps things bright and keeps things up and keeps things different and just keeps it interesting.
I absolutely agree with that, and I hope we get more people in the business that think that way, and the guys that are in the business now, you know, who haven't yet adopted that look on and feel of things, you know, adopts it, because you can't take advantage of new technology. For instance, IP over audio, if you're afraid of it, and it's probably a benefit to your company to get into that and to look into that. You can't adopt SIP technology to cut your telecom costs if you're afraid of it or you don't understand it. Read as much as you can. Listen to podcasts like the one that we're doing now. And, you know, read every publication out there. Read some of the boards, you know, that are out there where engineers comment and chime. Be a member of the SBE and read the SBE boards where people talk about stuff. And network. You know, my first several NABs that I went to, I paid for out of my pocket. My first NAB, I didn't know anybody. People didn't even talk to me. But I just milled around the booth to kind of make some contacts and learn and, you know, got a few business cards. Some of those people I still talk to today. Network and make friends with people. SB is a great way to do that in your community. I was in San Francisco 2 weeks. I'm not a member of that SBA chapter. My engineer said, well, we were going to go to lunch today at the SBE deal. But, you know, you're here, so, you know, we'll go to lunch with you. I said, hell no, don't do that. I'm going to go with you to your SBE meeting. And I went to the and signed a sheet like everybody else and sat there for 2 hours while Hale did a presentation on all his microphones and the history of rock and roll, which was fabulous. Go and network with people. And I met some people at that seminar, the SBE lunch at San Francisco, that, you know, I didn't know, or maybe had heard of, but had never met, never put a face and a name together, and shook hands. And I've done that in cities like Youngstown, Ohio. So even I go out, and I know a lot of people, but I still go out and love to network. And it's a great tool, and I think the people listening to this should do that and read everything they can about technology. And someday, they will probably end up on this podcast with you asking them questions about what they think about things and where they see technology headed, and then they can have their 2 cents worth and be part of, be part of change.
Gary, I think we could have you on a whole lot longer, so I'm going to invite you back sometime in the next couple of months or so. We'd love to have you back on and share some more of your thoughts, especially about the Arbitron PPM and whatever else is topical at the time. Would you do that for us?
Absolutely. Anytime you want to talk, I'm happy to do it. We'll talk to you about PPM or whatever else is going on in the industry, you know, at the time that we chat. Happy to do it.
All right. Gary, thanks very much. We're going to actually, this is the end of the show, Gary, so if you want to say goodbye, and I want to thank Gary Klein for being with us live from his car, and also Chris Tobin from New York. Chris, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, anytime.
Chris Tarr from Milwaukee. Chris, good to have you here for the first time.
It's been a party.
And we'll have you back. And Tom Ray, thanks for joining us again, Tom.
Oh, thanks for asking me back, Kirk.
And thanks to you all, the listeners, for joining us on This Week in Radio Tech. We'll be back next week.